and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, listeners. This is Simon Ward, host of the weekly Triathlon Coach Swatcast. And today we are returning to our series of the legends of British triathlon. And our first female guest is a lady who was right in the vanguard of the development and growth of British triathlon back in the 80s and early 90s. It's Sarah Coop. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you.
How are you today? You're in Brighton, I think, are you still?
Eastbourne, down in the south, right on the southeast coast, Eastbourne, yeah.
So nice weather down there for you. Have you got some of these winter storm or sort of like April storms that are coming in off the English Channel?
No. Good, sunny, little chilly, but no, nice bright day. Good weather down here.
Yeah. Okay, now, Sarah, for those of you who don't know, Sarah was the first British female to finish on the podium back in Hawaii back in 1991. And that's not her only claim to fame. She was also six-time European champion, and she'd probably tell me, although I couldn't find it anywhere, how many British championships she won. But Sarah, I'd like to really go back right back to the very beginning. When you were growing up, what was your sporting background? Probably from when you started running and cycling and swimming.
I think when I was a child, it was all music for me. Everything was music. And I was a very sporty child, but didn't really get access to any sporting clubs or anything. It was all just music lessons and instruments and things. And so as soon as I was old enough to get out myself and get myself to a running group, I did that. And I was probably not until I was about 16 or 17. And then with swimming, I grew up swimming in the sea because I lived by the coast. Every day, pretty much in the summer, we'd be at the beach and I'd be in the sea. And that's where I learned to swim. And that's where I did all my swimming as a child. I never really swam in a pool. So I picked all of it up once I got to the age where I could get myself to things and be a bit more independent.
And where did you grow up, Sarah? Have you always lived in the Brighton and Eastbourne? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've swam in the sea at Eastbourne. It can get quite rough down there at times.
It can. It gets really rough. But I think if you grow up with it and you're used to it and you go in all the way through the summer, you get used to everything. You get high waves, strong currents, you know. And I just found pool swimming very boring. I didn't really enjoy it. I thought it was hot and smelly and busy, and it wasn't something that I enjoyed, whereas I love swimming in the sea. So all of my swimming as a child and growing up was sea swimming.
So was there any formal training as a swimmer then in the sea? I mean, I know there are groups that do open water swimming, although they've become more popular in recent years. So you just really were splashing around in the water and learning to stay afloat and survive, really.
Yeah, I did. I taught myself to swim in the sea when I was about seven, with a ball kicking along and then using the sand, pulling myself along on the bottom. And there was no formal training. I'd swim in there with my dad and we'd swim out to various buoys that were out in the water and things like that. So we used to swim quite hard and quite long, but it wasn't it wasn't training as such. It was more just going for a swim and playing in the sea.
Well, maybe that's something we can come back to later, Sarah, when we talk about your role as a coach and the role of, particularly when you're developing young athletes, of the role of play versus the role of training. I think that's something that's quite important.
Yeah, very much, very much. I think all of my early experiences were through play.
Right. Okay. So you joined a running group at 16. And did you find that you took to running quite quickly as well then?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I'd always skated a lot as a child. I did a huge amount of roller skating, as it was then, a lot. I used to cover a lot of distance on it. So my legs were strong. And I used to find running at school very easy. If we had cross countries and things, I'd always find that easy. But I never took it any further. I did the school race, and then I never really did anything other than just some school things. So once I got to the running club and joined them, I mean, I was a fit child, so I found the running quite easy and developed quite quickly with that. And it was also at the stage when there was a fun run boom starting. So I got very much into that, enjoying going along and doing various fun runs and local runs. And that's really how my running developed, through that side of things.
You said you were doing your roller skating there. Did you used to go to a roller rink, or were you skating along the front in Eastbourne?
No, on the front, on the seafront. So we'd have a big group, would meet up, just friends really. And again, it was just play. I'd skate down from where I lived, which was a few miles, and then we'd spend a few hours skating, and then I'd skate home. So without realizing it was really good training, but at the time for me it was just meeting some friends and having fun.
What's going through my mind here is the similarity between this and I guess children growing up in Scandinavia that are cross-country skiing, because it's a very similar sort of action without the impact. Because you skate for a long period of time, you're building up a really good aerobic base at a low intensity, which is exactly the foundation that you need for endurance sport.
Yeah, it was, and it was accidental. That was a funny thing. It wasn't something that was planned or factored in. It was just purely, it was something that I enjoyed doing, so I'd go and do it. And as it turned out, it was a really good base for me to do what I chose to do later on.
Chrissy Wellington talks about that a little bit, when people say, where did she suddenly come from? And yet she says, well, I used to just do things like mountain biking in the Himalayas, you know. It was fun and it was adventure, but I guess it set her up for what came later as a professional sports person.
Yeah, very, very much so. I think you can't underestimate enough the advantage of that aerobic fitness when you're a child. I think it's really important.
Mm. So 16 or 17, you were running, you were doing the fun runs then. If you don't mind me trying to put a link to your age at this point, then, Sarah, 16 or 17 would have been what year?
I think it was the early 80s. I mean, it was the early 80s that I started to run. They did a 10-mile fun run around where I live, and I fancied having a go at that. And that seemed like an absolute marathon to me at the time, but I thought it sounded like quite good fun. So my target was to try not to walk and have a go, and I did it. And then, I would say it's probably, I don't know, maybe about 81, 82. And then I was just looking for more to do because I'd enjoyed it and built it from there, really.
Okay, so you were running and swimming, mostly for fun.
Yeah.
Was it this point after you'd done the 10-mile fun run? Was that when things started to get competitive and you started to be a bit more serious about your activity, or were you still just doing it for fun?
Well, I think I've always been a really competitive person within myself. Against myself, so I want to try something to see if I can do it. And then once the run started to go quite well, then I wanted to see if I could maybe place higher or run a faster time. So first my targets were seeing if I could do a race holding a 7-minute mile, and then that gradually went down to 6 minutes and just things like that. So I was sort of competitive within myself, I think. So I'd find races and place events that I could go and challenge and see if I could hit these targets.
Okay. At what point did triathlon become a part of your life then?
I think that was in 84. I had some friends doing it. And funnily enough, it was a bit of an accident because I'd never had a bike as a child. I was never able to have a bike. So I didn't start riding until I was about 17, and I was borrowing a bike to ride to work and crashed into the back of a car. And it was quite a serious accident, but the positive side of that was that the insurance money enabled me to get a racing bike, which was what then led me to meet the people who introduced me to triathlon. So that was probably the link that got me to link the three sports together, was going into the bike shop to get the bike and meeting the people in there who were doing some triathlon, and they talked to me about it. And that's where I started to try and put the three things together.
So that race in 1984, then, where was it? There wouldn't have been a great deal of choice in 1984, I don't think.
No. I mean, I went to one, it was in Dorking in Surrey, called Tanner's Hatch. And I can't remember the name of the guy who organised it. I think it was Graham Pedder, maybe? Something.
Okay.
It was a very, very random event. It was an 800-meter pool swim. You then had a set amount of time to get out, get changed, and get over to where the bike started. You rode about 25 miles on the bike, came back, and then you had a 16-mile run.
Wow.
Which was crazy because I'd never done anything like that before. And, so I did that and had a go, and I really enjoyed it. And then met Karen Groves at that race. She was the lady who won it. And
sorry, what was her name?
Karen Groves.
Karen Groves, okay.
Yeah, so she was one of the early founders of the sport. And, she was lovely and, you know, really sort of positive and talked to me a lot about it and encouraged me. And then I went away and thought, oh, I'll do a few more the next year. And 85 was probably the first year where I did quite a lot in that year. I trained hard over that winter and went to Milton Keynes, which was the nationals in May 85.
Okay, so let's talk about the winter then. You've decided to do some serious training on the back of that first triathlon. How did you decide to go about your training? Because again, we talk about there wouldn't have been much choice for triathlon. I don't think 220 existed until much later than that. So Dave Scott didn't write his book until 1986. So there wouldn't have been a great deal of guidance for you for training specifically for a triathlon. So you'd have been like everybody else, just looking at what runners and swimmers and cyclists did.
Yeah, I mean, I had to learn how to ride a bike. I didn't know anything about a bike, and I hooked up with a bunch of people from the local bike shop, some young guys who were a few years younger than me, but really, really helpful. And they used to go out riding with me and show me, you know, routes and teach me a lot about riding. And that was invaluable because that really helped me understand about how to train on the bike and what it was. And, you know, I mean, I really wouldn't have had a clue if I'd just been on my own on that front. And then swimming was probably the hardest one because I had to switch to the pool for the winter, which I'd never really done before. So initially I would just go along and swim the distance that I was going to be racing and got bored of doing that. And eventually I hooked up with an age group swimming club, just a regular swimming club, and swam with some very young kids in there doing their basic training, which was hard. And then just started to put some bike runs together and, you know, really just sort of use my imagination as to how to start putting it together to be able to do what we now know as an Olympic distance triathlon that Milton Keynes was.
Looking back on that training now, do you think you Do you think you did too much? Do you think that you didn't do enough? Was it all hard or easy? Was there any real structure, or did you just do what you fancied and was based around? I guess there would be certain fixed points, wouldn't there? Like the bike ride with the club would perhaps be on a Saturday or Sunday. The pool swimming, you would have fixed times. But was everything else just randomly fitted into your day?
No, I think, obviously it was the first winter I was doing it, so it was trial and error, but I think it was definitely structured. I definitely had a plan and tried to follow it. I was always guilty of doing too much. That was just my personality. I'd always end up doing far too much. And in hindsight, you know, potentially would have done better without that. But I think from intensity point of view, I just balanced it intuitively, really. I'd do some hard runs and some long runs and some tempo runs. I think it was just quite intuitive, really, and it's developed now over the years, but I think back then I still had the same principles in place, really.
I had a conversation with Bernie Shrewsbury, who you'll remember well. Going back to those same years, and Bernie was sort of getting on one about the overuse of gadgets these days, and how back in his day, you know, you had to do it on feel and you had to understand what your body was telling you. And he said, we all still train hard, but, you know, if nobody was watching a watch and saying, oh, I can't go out today because this tells me I've got to rest for another 48 hours. You're talking about intuitive then. I guess you also had to learn to listen to your body and respond accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, I was then and probably still am a real shy away from anything measured and tech, because it's just not me. I think at the time Sarah Springman was very, very into her figures and her numbers and testing, and you know, that was how she wanted to progress, and I think I was sort of more the opposite. And I don't think one's right or wrong, and I think technology is brilliant. Yeah. It can absolutely help and guide and stop overtraining, and you know, I think it's really good. I think for me personally, I like to do things intuitively and see how and go by how I feel. And I'd always race in Ironman how I felt. I never would have any numbers or any figures there. It would always just be going by how I felt. And I don't knock any technology, because I think it's brilliant and really does help structure training so much. But it's just the reasons why I do it is because I enjoy the freedom of it, and I don't really like to be restricted to numbers.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. And it's interesting that there are different approaches, of course. Again, I was listening to Dave Scott chatting, and he was talking about in Kona a few years later, there was a guy from Finland, you might remember, Pauli Kiuru. Mm-hmm. And Pauli was one of the first to really be using polar heart rate monitors in a big way. And Dave said, you know, Pauli could have won Kona if his heart rate hadn't been telling him to slow down. If he'd just listened to his body and gone by feel, he would have won. But the heart rate monitor said slow down, so he did, and he came second. And whereas Dave was another one, just go hard and do it by feel.
That's a very good point. And Pauli was known for that. I mean, his heart rate, it was a joke that his name was synonymous with that word, because he would always be totally guided by what the numbers said. And I think that's very true. I remember when I got my first polar heart rate monitor, it would have probably been about 86, maybe 87 sort of time.
Yeah, sounds right.
And it was hilarious, because they didn't have this download function and we didn't have computers and things. So after training, I would sit there and write down. You could either have your heart rate every 15 seconds or every minute, depending on how long you'd recorded. And I would just write these numbers down, I'd have this whole page of numbers, which would be my heart rate at every 15 seconds or something. So, you know, we did use them at the time, but I think it was never something that I particularly took too seriously, the heart rate measuring and everything.
I remember getting the book that went with that. I think it was Scientific Training with Polar Heart Rate Monitor. Yeah. And I didn't. I was only just getting into sort of triathlon then. I didn't really understand the physiology behind it all. So trying to make head and tail of all of those figures and then read this book and try to understand what it was telling me meant that I had lots of sleepless nights wondering whether I was getting it right or not. I think even now I've got more knowledge, I still would struggle to follow that book. I may have to try and dig it out and see how complex it really was.
I think very often now, looking at the heart rate monitors and benefits of them, I think for a lot of the people, it's useful to use it to go easy enough. I think that's the thing sometimes, especially with younger people, they're doing a lot of their training very hard. And that's where sometimes, just as a guide, the monitor can be useful to keep them in that more aerobic area.
Yes, I think you're right, actually. I think a lot of gadgetry people use, as you say, to try to push themselves too hard. And personally, I think the biggest benefit from can actually use it as a cap and sort of, you know, show them how to go a bit easier. And also, I've been promoting quite heavily, you know, the sort of like very low intensity running, 70%, nice and easy, enjoyable, you know, nose breathing. And a lot of it just happens by default that a lot of the guys that are doing and girls that are doing high volume training tend to fall into this sort of large quantities at low intensity and some high intensity, because that's the only way to do it and recover. However, it still seems to work for age group athletes, but they seem to feel that because they've got limited time, they have to go hard all the time, and that it's just a short road to nowhere, really.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's probably for me the most use for it, or the best use for it. Generally, athletes know when they're going hard and when they're going hard enough, but they don't often know when they're going easy enough.
Well, it's interesting there, Sarah, that if you and Bernie were sat there together, you'd be saying the same thing. I'm sure some of it is to do with the era you were brought up in, you know, where you had to rely on what your body was telling you rather than gadgetry. And, you know, something you've mentioned several times already is about play and about fun and enjoyment. And again, I think that a lot of the age group athletes today are not, and a lot of the full-time athletes are just not having that. It's too serious, and that's damaging as well.
I wouldn't have done it. I mean, for me, I love doing swimming, biking, running. I love pushing myself. I love climbing the routes. I love going and seeing how hard I could go up a big long hill. All those things. That was what I chose to do for fun. It wasn't because I wanted to win something. It wasn't because I wanted to get a title. It was because that's what I enjoyed doing, and I think sometimes that gets lost.
You know, I've seen Alistair and Jonathan Brownlee. I've talked about them many times on the podcast, and I've known them since they joined the squad that Jack and I were running, similar to the one that Glenn was running back in sort of the early 2000s down there in Eastbourne. And you know, theirs was all based around just going out having fun. They like swimming, they like biking, and they like running, and they like doing lots of it. And you know, if we tried to cap that, to curb it, to restrict it in some way when they were in their teens, that might actually have meant that we never got the results and that domination and that growth of the sport that we did. But they still like that now, and that comes across in their books, that comes across in everything they do. And they've said many times that if they weren't being paid to race, they'd still be doing all that stuff because they just love that sort of lifestyle.
Yeah, I think that's the thing is, I think in a way, though, the sport's too hard to do it if you don't love it. Yeah. I mean, it's too hard. Why would you do it if it's something that isn't really what you love doing? And I don't think you'll ever get the best out of yourself unless you love it.
Okay, Sarah. So let's go back to 1985 then. So you did the MK Milton Keynes Nationals. How did you get on there?
You know what? I actually don't remember how I did there. I remember I was in the, I must have been in the top two or three. I don't know. I think maybe Sarah won it. Sarah Springman. I can't remember. But I qualified for a home international there and went to Ireland the following week or the 2 weeks later for a home international. That was fun.
Was that the race that was in Northern Ireland? I can't remember the name of it. Garrett McCarthy became synonymous with that race, didn't he, I think?
Yeah, it was. It was in Northern Ireland. And what I didn't find out till later was that because there was a lot of IRA activity at the time, that we had some guard with us. When we were riding on the bike, we had a motorcyclist police guard with us because we, I don't think we were terribly welcome there, the English team. but luckily, I didn't find that out till later.
Wow. That's a little story in itself, isn't it, then, security guard?
Yeah. Riding. Well, it was all over my head. I didn't really know much about it. But once we'd finished and were on the way home, we were told about it. But where I first met Glenn, that race.
Oh, okay. Okay. And was that love at first sight then, do you think? Or was that just a friendship that grew over time as you met each other again at various races?
I think it was just a friendship, really, that grew. We both liked doing the same things, and we enjoyed, you know, racing and training, and we got on well, and it just developed from there, really.
You mentioned Sarah Springman. The two Sarahs were synonymous with the growth of triathlon throughout the 80s and early 90s. Do you think that was a sort of like female rivalry, like Cohen Ovett at the time, or like Dave Scott and Mark Allen? Or Erin Baker and Paula Newby-Fraser?
I think, to be honest, I mean, we were about as polar opposite as you could get as people, but we respected each other hugely. And, you know, Sarah was very helpful to me in the beginning, helping me get a sponsor for my bike. She put me in touch with her sponsors. And she was really, you know, really kind and really, really helpful. But we were very different people. We came at things from very different angles. And, you know, obviously there was rivalry there, but I don't think it was anything that was bad or, you know, I think it was healthy because what it did is encouraged us both to train hard to try and beat each other, which brought our level up hugely.
You mentioned then the home international event. And I guess from there, then you became one of the dominant females in triathlon in the UK. At what point did you start winning races and spending more time racing in Europe and internationally?
Well, I think through 85, as the season went on, I got stronger and stronger because longer days meant I could train more. And I started to get a bit more experience at the races. And I ended up doing quite a few. I can't really remember exact positions and things where I came up. I know I won some in 85. Actually, I think I went to Europeans in 85, which was in Immenstadt in Germany. And that was a really beautiful race. And I remember coming third there. And that was quite a big race, tough race. And I, you know, that was a big deal for me there. And then at the end of that season, I decided I wanted to have a go at Nice. And bearing in mind, I was still very young. I was probably only about 20. It was a very long way for me to race. But, yeah, I did it and thoroughly enjoyed it. So I would say as 85 went on, I trained harder, trained more, raced more, and really started to, you know, get strong by the end of the season.
Was that 1986 when you trained for Nice?
No, 85. I did Nice in 85.
It was a late season race.
It was October.
Yeah? Okay. How did you get on in Nice then? Because that is a different type of racing, isn't it? The ride was through the Alpe Maritime. The swim was in the sea. So you'd have enjoyed that, and then you run all the way along the front and back.
Yeah,
similar to the way they do now on the Ironman.
Except for when I got to Nice, I found out the Americans were there, and I found out that they were all wearing wetsuits, and they were all telling me that it was going to be so much quicker. So along with a couple of friends, we went to the local diving shop and bought a wetsuit.
Right.
That with a fork. Oh dear. It had no arms and it was really baggy, and I started swimming and felt like I was drowning. So took this suit off halfway through my swim, and it's still probably floating in the sea somewhere. And decided that no, the wetsuits were a really stupid idea. And so that was my first introduction to wetsuits.
And what about the bike ride then?
The ride was good.
I mean, there are a few.
It's lovely. It was very hilly, but the hills are quite nice there. They're not like stupid steep. You could ride quite a few of them in your big chain ring. And the technical descents I hated because I didn't have a strong bike background. I didn't like the descents there because they were mossy and slippy and twisty, and that wasn't very fun. And then when we came back in, we had a 20-mile run that went 10 miles out to Cannes and then 10 miles back. And that was lovely, like that. And I can't remember. I think I must maybe came about 12th or 13th or something in that race. But my target really was to go and do it and finish it. That was my goal.
Do you remember who your main competitors were at that stage? Because no doubt you would meet them again on future races in 86 and 87.
I think at that race, Linda Buchanan, who was an American athlete, I mean, to me, the Americans, they were so strong and so dominant in that race. They were all very friendly and very lovely. And that's where I think there was Colleen Cannon. Maybe the Punto sisters were there. And at that race, I made friends with some of them who invited me out to America for the winter. So by the end of 85, Glenn and I took the decision to go and spend the winter out there, along with a couple of other English guys, to just sort of continue developing what we were doing, really. And at the time, it looked to me like the Americans were way ahead of where we were. So decided that that's where we needed to be to learn a bit more. And yeah.
Wow. So
then in December, we went out there.
I've interviewed Robin Brew and Bernie Shrewsbury, and both of them were sort of involved in the spot. Robin was maybe a bit later, but certainly Bernie was saying, you know, Glenn was the first one really to go out to the United States and training probably in, were you in San Diego at that time? Because that was the big hub for triathlon then, wasn't it?
Yeah, North County. Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah. So what particularly did you learn about being in San Diego then and training with the Americans?
I think the thing I loved about being there was it was just it was normal. When we were doing what we were doing in England at that time, it was very unusual. Whereas when we lived there, we had a whole heap of people who were doing the same thing. And that made it really easy because it was just a big group of friends who were training together. We had, I think they called it Master Swim Squad there, which we could do. So that brought the swimming on very well because it was really specific for what we wanted. And then in the winter, we had a lot of Europeans had come over there. So people like Jürgen Zach, Wolfgang, Dietrich, and then the Australians, Greg Welsh, people like that. And then Paula Newby-Fraser was my training partner. We were good friends, trained a lot together. So people like that, really. And we all just had big group sessions and trained a lot.
Yeah. That was the nucleus, wasn't it? I can remember the early triathlete magazines was all about, you know, winter in San Diego, the American training groups. Yeah. It was the real mecca for triathlon in the late 80s. If I don't know if you've ever listened to any of the Brad Cairns podcasts, but he talks about that. And, you know, there was a regular run that went from a coffee shop, wasn't there? I think was it every Thursday night or something?
Well,
people turn up and have a race.
The main run was a Tuesday run.
Tuesday.
Rancho Santa Fe, and it was around the horse trails. And it was great. We'd have everybody who was in town, really. People would come in and train there for a month or so, and everyone who was there would come to that run. It was early. It was about 7:30 in the morning. But and then we'd all just set off together. We'd have a route, and there wasn't really very often a structured session. It was more just a good tempo run, I suppose, what you call it now, up to an hour and 20, depending on what time of year. And that run went on all year. That was always on. And then we'd have the Wednesday ride. The Wednesday ride would be up the coast. Anything from probably the shortest we'd do would be about 70 and the longest would be 100. And that would go up to San Clemente and back. And then you'd get we'd have up to 100 people on that ride sometimes. It would be huge.
Oh.
It was very big.
And that was that along the Pacific Coast Highway then?
Pacific Coast, yeah. Through Camp Pendleton.
Yeah. It's lovely. Yeah, well, and of course you wouldn't be able to go through Camp Pendleton these days. In fact, they've got as we're talking there, they've got the Oceanside Triathlon at Camp Pendleton, and there's all sorts of security things that you have to do. So it takes place this Saturday, and I think anybody that wants to race has to register with the Marines, and they have to get special security passes and everything to get allowed on the base and what have you. But
that's really sad. We used to like riding through there. It was great because it was pretty much traffic free. So once you got to that point, you could really. I mean, I suppose in a way I used to treat that a bit like a race because we'd have really strong cyclists there. We'd have a lot of the pro cyclists would come and spend some time there in the winter and they'd come out on that ride. So I can remember just you always had to be near the front to get through the gates on the camp first. If you were near the back, you'd get dropped. And so it was always... it was always a bit of a race for me. I loved it because it used to be trying to get up through that gate first so you could get away with the front group before getting dropped. Yeah, it was good fun. And then, so that I suppose they were the key sessions. There was another key one that was one of my favorites, which was Mount Palomar, which goes inland. And there's about a 12-mile climb up to an Indian reservation up there. And that used to be probably my favourite ride there. It's a 100-mile round trip, but halfway through you'd be climbing this mountain. That would be very fun.
After spending a few months in America then, you must have come back to the UK in the spring feeling like you'd ready to take on the whole world.
Well, I mean, I was completely much, much more developed athlete than I had been the year before because I'd just dedicated everything to it for the last 6 months. I had no savings when I went over there. I went over there on a credit card and four of us shared a motel room. And the motel owner was lovely because they put four beds in a room for us so we could share. And it certainly wasn't all set up and nice. You know, everything laid on. It was absolutely tough, really tough that first winter, but it was what we needed to do to get ourselves in shape to be competitive.
Did you meet Bob Babbitt around that time? Because I think he moved to San Diego in the mid 80s, didn't he? Because he was around for the he'd been around for the very first Ironman races, and he was telling us about the guy who had the truck that had the had the RV that he lived in right next to the bar. I can't remember his name now. But, Bob must have been a character on the triathlon scene in San Diego.
Yeah, he was. He actually didn't do a lot of the sessions that we did, but he was always around. And he did, he set up a magazine called The Competitor. And it was so good because it had every resource for every event, it had all the running events, all the little events that were on, he put it in there. And so that was like our Bible because we didn't have computers and stuff to refer to. So that came out every week and, was really good.
Yeah, I think in terms of Bob's athletic pedigree, well, he wouldn't have considered him to be one of the leading contenders, would he? But he definitely was part of that triathlon scene, and he was definitely a participant. Oh. And most people knew Bob because he's just got such a likable character.
Yeah. I mean, what he's doing now is just brilliant with, you know, his Challenged Athletes Foundation. It's so good to see the success he's having with bringing those athletes on and making them really feel proud of themselves. And, you know, he's had some that have got through to the Olympics, and, you know, he's doing a great job.
Mm. Yeah, I had Bob on the show quite a while back now. Fantastic. I didn't get much chance to say anything, but fortunately Bob's stories are always very amusing and interesting. And he was a good guest. Okay, so 1980, let's talk about the sort of 1986 years and onwards then. Once you started, I presume that became just before we go on to that, I presume that sort of winter in San Diego became a regular occurrence then for you and Glenn then, some of the other British athletes.
Moved out and we spent majority of our time over there and came back for blocks of time to do some races. So probably the most I raced in the UK was in 85 and 86. And then I only did a couple of races because we spent a lot of time away.
Okay. So, I mean, you won 6 European championships during your career. So can you tell me a little bit about those? When were they? And, they must have been in those bits where you were just coming back to Europe to compete for Great Britain.
Well,
the
first one I did was a combined. It was I'm trying to think, it was in 86, and that was the Olympic distance triathlon. And I had a cold and I was feeling really under the weather, and I was gutted because I'd been in such good shape coming back from America, gone into this race with a cold. I think I finished second or third and was really, I was really gutted when I finished because I knew that I felt like I could have gone around the race again, but I didn't have the speed in my legs because I wasn't feeling well. And then a few months later, we had the 70.3 Europeans, and I was just so determined there to try and get everything out of myself. And that was the first one that I won in Brussels in Belgium. We had a girl called Liv Paulus, who was a very good Belgian swimmer, who was leading it. And then I passed her. I think I passed her on the run. And, so that was my first one that I won.
I'm trying to think about who the other European competition would have been then. And the only name that really comes to mind is Thea Sebesma from Holland.
There was loads. There was Liv Paulus. There was the Moutons, Isabel Mouton, Beatrice Mouton. Simone Mortier, Sonia Krolik from Germany, Chantal Malherbe from France, Alexander Kramer from Germany. Yeah, I mean, there were some very good girls. I mean, Liv Paulus was a very good swimmer. And then Sonia Krolik was a very good runner who went on to run. I'm not sure whether she ran at the Olympics. She sort of represented Germany at running and in the marathon and things, as well as doing triathlon. She was a very, very good runner. And the Moutons, they were just good all round triathletes.
European. So did you win that race? Did you say you won that race? You passed Liv on the run and.
Yeah, that was my first one that I won. I'm trying to think. I can't remember if I went to Nice that year. No, I can't remember. I think I probably did, but I don't remember I don't remember how it went or anything really about that. I just remember doing Brussels that year. That was my main race.
Did you ever win in Nice?
No, I came second. Never won.
Okay, so European champions then, of the 6 victories, how were they distributed amongst Olympic distance, half Ironman, and long course?
So I won one Olympic distance at Marseille in France, and 3 70.3s and 2 Ironman.
Now, just going back to Olympic distance there, I think 1986 was the year Glenn came second in the World Championship, wasn't it?
No, I think that was 87, wasn't it? I don't know. It was either 86 or... Yeah, no, I think you... I thought it was 87, but it might be 86. I can't remember.
Okay, and I can't remember who... Did he get beaten by Mark Allen?
Yeah.
Okay. So, did you race at the World? I can't remember if that was the very first World Triathlon Championships as well. Then, but did you race at the World Championships?
Yeah, I did race there, and I think I was 12th. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So were you getting a sense at this point then that the longer distances suited you more?
Well, they did suit me more because of my swimming, because I didn't come from a swimming background, so for me and I was a very strong runner relatively to my swimming. So the longer distance suited me. The problem for me with the Olympic distance was the swim deficit was more significant in Olympic distance than it was in a Ironman. So I could.
And of course, at this time, Olympic distance racing was non-drafting as well, wasn't it? We didn't get the draft legal racing until much later.
Yeah, I mean,
on.
I think that probably helped me a little bit, actually, because you could, you know, I think nowadays, once the packs are formed coming out of the swim, you've got no chance of closing anything down, whereas at least then, before it was drafting, you had more of a chance of closing it down. And Ironman obviously wasn't drafting, so it was you and get your head down and find out what the gap is and close it down. And that was much easier to do than in Ironman or 70.3 than it was in Olympic distance.
The two Ironman races that you won the European Championships, where were they?
One was in Finland. And one was in Denmark.
Oh, okay. Right. So not Almere then. Almere was a regular, wasn't it, on the sort of championship scene?
Yeah,
I think
Almere was the Europeans in 86, the year before I did it, because Sarah went and won that one. Sarah Springman won that. And then Finland was really lovely, lovely race, place called Uroinen, I think it was. And, cold swim, but lovely. And I mean, when I did my first Ironman, I hadn't swam, biked or run the distances individually. So I was just so excited really to see if I could do it. So I didn't know if I could do it. And that was the thing that really, I remember being awake nearly all night the night before because I just wanted it to start. And it was just really good fun trying to, you know, wonder whether I could do it. But the thing that I still can't quite believe is that I didn't actually eat anything on that first Ironman I did, except for a couple of orange slices on the run. They had sort of cut oranges on the run with water, and I had a couple of those. But I can't imagine now being able to do an Ironman on water.
You must have been properly fat adapted there then, Sarah, to be able to...
Yeah. Well, I think it was quite lucky as well because the temperature was good. It wasn't too hot. But I thought I didn't want to have to stop and go to the loo. So I thought, well, if I don't eat anything, then I'll be fine. So that was my very bad nutritional plan for my first Ironman.
I can just imagine the nutritionist listening to this, pulling their hair out.
Yeah, well, you know how
with the way that
hindsight is a wonderful thing, and knowledge is a wonderful thing, but we didn't have that at that time. So for me, it made complete sense if I didn't want to have to stop to use the loo, then I just wouldn't eat anything and then I'd be fine. So in some strange way, that seemed quite logical to me at the time. But
I'm trying to think when there wasn't really any specific endurance sports nutrition, I don't think, at that point. I can remember, sort of remember when Power Bar started.
Oh, yeah.
I think it might have been after that. I can remember Maxim starting as well. I mean, Power Bar might have been going in the States and available in San Diego way before it was in Europe. But I remember somebody coming up with this neutral tasting white powder that looked like corn flour and just mixed it with water. And it tasted foul, but it was supposed to get all of this, you know, carbohydrate into your system.
Yeah, I mean, all of that.
And then after that, I think high five came, but that was about it.
That all came in the mid to late 80s, I would say. I mean, certainly, I think I did my first Ironman in 87, and I didn't really have any knowledge of carbo loading or anything then. It was really just a case of what's around, what food's available, and I'll eat that. But for the race, I didn't have anything. I tried the same strategy in Nice the next year, and that went horribly wrong because it was so hot.
So, I mean, you weren't the only one who was having to find a way with nutrition. So what was everybody else eating on the bike then?
Well, I think Sarah had a good concoction of stuff. I remember her having a whole host of heap of prepared food and bits and pieces in a bike jersey and all sorts of things, but I didn't really pay much attention to what it was or why she was doing it. I just remember her being a lot more prepared than I was with it. And I mean, it wasn't until the following year when I had a very bad experience with heat exhaustion in Nice, that I started to look at fueling properly, and from then, you know, I went away and learned a lot more about it. But until I needed to, I think I didn't really.
But nevertheless, if those products like Power Bar and Maxim and everything else weren't available, then you still had to rely on what we call real food, I suppose.
It was real food. I mean, I'm trying to remember what Sarah had. I just remember her having lots of packets of different, but it was real food. It was sandwiches and things like that. And then, I mean, Power Bar came out late 80s probably, and then I can remember in races just sticking the pieces, breaking it into pieces and sticking it onto my top tube as I rode. Then I'd just peel a piece off.
Did you have the same experience that I did then? Because I think I've probably seen a photograph. It may have been your bike or, you know, one of your competitors or somebody. And there was bits of Power Bar that was stuck, cut into probably, you know, small bike-sized chunks and stuck on the top tube. Right? I think it was Iron Bridge that I was doing. So I'd dutifully gone along, got two Power Bars and chopped them up and sort of beautifully arranged. And I decided I was going to have one every 20 minutes, you know, and that would see me through the bike. And I got this lovely, I can't remember what bike it was, but it was a frame that was known for having a really nice paint job. So I've got this lovely sort of purple and sort of shimmery turquoise bike. Fantastic looking it was. And as I was riding along, I was thinking, right, I was really excited. Started to peel my first bit of Power Bar off, and half of the top tube paint came with it. So I couldn't eat that one. And then now my beautifully painted bike was slowly being destroyed, so I thought, well, I better tab the other one. I peeled that off and the paint came with it, and I carried on trying to peel off a bit of Power Bar until I had nothing to eat. The whole of the top tube was now had no paint on it, and I, like you, had one of those terrible experiences when I got back to T2. I was just completely wiped out because I'd probably pushed too hard on the bike, and I'd had nothing to eat and just been drinking water. And it cost me several hundred pounds to respray the bike.
Oh, no.
So that strategy didn't work for me.
No, I never had that. That's awful. Oh, I wonder why the paint came off.
I don't know. I was just remember at the time. I remember thinking, well, I can't eat that now. I'm just throwing it into the hedge, and it, because I was so pissed off that I couldn't eat anything. It never really occurred to me that I was now going to have to have my whole bag.
Oh, that's really frustrating. The worst thing that happened with the power bar, to me, was that if you were in a really cold environment and it would just get solid and you couldn't, it would be like the rock.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you lose your teeth.
It didn't really work. But, no, I mean, I would say Nice, I got to about 18 miles on the run. About 18 miles on the run, decided I needed to stop and get a drink and stopped at an aid station and fainted and came round and then did the wobbly walk for the last, jog, kept trying to move forwards for the last 2 miles. I think it was pretty dangerous, you know, how poorly you get after those types of things. And then tried 2 weeks later. At that time, they had Nice 2 weeks before Hawaii. So I'd gone out to Hawaii to try and do that. But I only got to about 25 miles on the bike in Hawaii then and had to stop because I was just still really unwell, which was very frustrating.
Let's talk about Hawaii a bit then. I don't recall that there was a qualification in the early days. So could you just enter?
No, you had, at that time, you had a pro or a license, pro license, or you had certain slots that you had to do. And they had an Ironman series, and then you got points from the Ironman series. So you got entry to the Kona that way. I mean, obviously not everyone.
Okay. So
different age groups and things, but yeah, but the athletes who were racing for money, that's how they got in.
Okay. So which events did you have to do in order to book your ticket then?
I did New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and Hawaii, I think. Oh, and Japan. Five. And Japan.
All in the same year.
Yeah, we had.
Wow. Yeah, I do remember that as well as the World Championship, there was one or two years when they actually had that World Series. So somebody got the crown for being the winner of the World Series, which was points accrued through doing all of those races. And then obviously there was also the World Championship winning in Hawaii, wasn't there?
Yeah, and so I used to do that series. That was good. And then alongside that with Düsseldorf, which was the long distance duathlon in Switzerland.
Yeah, I recall that as well. I think that's still going now, isn't it? It's nowhere near as popular as it was then.
When we did it was a 20-mile run, and you went out from transition and pretty much ran uphill for 10 miles, and then you turned at the top and ran back down, and it was incredibly hard on your legs, the downhill. That was a huge race. We got loads of people from all around the world would come to that.
Let's talk about that Hawaii event then. Sarah, you were 1991. Yeah. You finished third. I mean, and you finished third in some pretty esteemed company. And you weren't that far behind Paula Newby-Fraser, who was the winner, and Erin Baker, both of whom were in the Ironman Hall of Fame and had multiple wins in Kona. There, tell us about that. Yeah, because there'll be a lot of listeners here who do Ironman and have aspirations to go and race in Kona, and there's been some changes to the sort of end of the bike run and the run section, but it's essentially the same sort of course as it was.
I think I was really lucky because my build up to that race, I trained every day with Paula, and we trained, really hard, as we had done for a few years leading into it before Ironman. We'd always do our training for it together. And so I think the preparation, it's more about the preparation before you get to Kona. It's more about being in the right environment, the right weather, I could never, I don't think I could have ever done well, as well there, had I gone from this country at that time of year. I think it's incredibly difficult to go from here to race in that environment. But where we were living in San Diego, it was hot and our rides were in the heat, our runs were in the heat, and it was all very specific. So moving over to Kona for the event, it wasn't a huge change in either time or weather conditions. So I think the race itself went fine, was absolutely fine. But I think the reason because of that was the build up to it, the training beforehand, being in the right temperature and really, really allowing myself to adapt to the weather conditions that I'd be facing in Hawaii.
And I mean, just explain some of the to some of the listeners then, what were the highs and lows of that particular race, or just was it one of those days that just went perfectly from the gun?
Well, it certainly didn't go perfectly before the gun, because when I got into transition on at that race, you have to put all your stuff in the night before because it's a very early start. And I turned up on my bike to check everything, yeah, and realized I'd left my bike shoes at the apartment that was about half an hour away. Well, jog half an hour. It's only a few miles driving, but the roads were all closed. And very luckily, a nice policeman drove me to my apartment to get my bike shoes. Otherwise, the outcome would have been very different. So I ended up coming back and arriving, putting my shoes in about 10 minutes before the start. So that was not a very good start to the day, for sure. And then the swim was fine. I mean, it's just a flat, calm swim in nice, warm water. So there's nothing difficult about the swim at all. And it's really just a case of seeing what the deficit was when I came out. And then picking off, trying to work through and pick off people, knowing the position I was in. When we got to Harvey, which is the halfway turn, pretty much right on cue, the winds changed. So we had headwinds both ways, which made it really tough. It's always that time of day. Once it gets to around 11-ish, the winds change direction. And I remember, as I was racing just in a very small Speedo two-piece, being very uncomfortable by the end of the bike. My hands were sore because I didn't have bike gloves on or anything like that. So I remember being really ready to get off my bike. And I think I'd closed down to about eighth, maybe seventh or eighth. But I knew that my run.
Can I just interrupt here, Sarah? In that year, you would have gone to the far end of town to Kiahu and into the area, yes, into the hotel, wouldn't you? And then had to run yeah, in and out of the pit, which was an awful start. When you're hot and uncomfortable, the last thing you want to do is run up a hill, down into a furnace, and then back out again to start your run.
You know, it's weird though. It didn't really bother me that much. I don't know why. I mean, I think I used to feel it would bother other people more, so I used to see it as an advantage, really, because if it was something that was quite hard, or I mean, it was unbelievably hot. It was just laughable how hot it was. It was like being in an oven. But if you're focusing on that as a negative, then it would be. But I never really did. I don't remember it being a negative. I just remember keep looking. I just had a very, very strict routine that at every mile's aid station, I would take on something. So whether it was a drink or a energy or something. But I would always, so, and then in my mind, I was just running aid station to aid station, so 1 mile at a time. And I mean, I know looking now, I can see that the conditions were hard and they were very, very hot. But I never really remember thinking about that when I was racing. I was just thinking about trying to catch the next person.
Were you at
no,
third when
I was
you got
in about
off the bike?
Eighth off the bike, but I knew.
So that must have given you some confidence as you were picking people off then and running yourself up.
Yeah, I knew
podium.
That the people, a lot of the people in front of me, I knew that I could catch them if I had a run that I'm capable of. So that's what I mean. In a way, I think I was just very single-minded in my quest. I was just trying to catch as many of them as I could, because I knew that if everything was going well, I should be able to catch up some of these girls. So I think I tended to completely ignore the conditions to some extent. But the reason I was able to do that was the training that I'd done in San Diego. So I think that's what I said initially when I say I think a lot of the result there, that was because of the training that I'd done leading into it, rather than on the day. Obviously, you have to deliver, but I couldn't have delivered it without the background training that I'd done with Paula.
Did you have to go into the energy lab on that run, or did you just run straight? You did go into the energy lab there.
That was like a fire pit. It was very, very hot. Yeah.
that bit, when you come back out from the bottom, you're in the hottest part of the day. It's quite nice running down there, isn't it? Because you've got a little bit of a breeze coming in off the ocean and you're running downhill. But then, of course, when you turn around, you've got to run back uphill and you've got the wind at your back. So it seems to just get
About 7 minutes away from water, away from another aid station, away from tipping water all over you. You know what I mean? It was, it didn't stretch out like a marathon to me. It just stretched out like one aid station to the next. And that makes it completely doable in your mind when you've broken it down like that.
What was the finish like for you then? Because I mean, there were way more spectators and crowds there. And back then in 1991, I've got a feeling that that they didn't have quite the sort of spectacular funnel that they have now. You did have a finish line as such, didn't you? Just by the pier, but it wasn't quite as demarked as it is.
Well, I don't know. It was pretty big, actually. It was huge. It was packed all down the final probably half a mile, and the finish was very very big, very, you know, it was a really spectacular finish area. And you know, the people were lining all the way up, as I say, at least the last half mile. It was a very lovely finish, actually. Really nice. Lots and lots of people there, and just such a nice feeling. I was so pleased. I was very happy with how I'd raced. So I was really pleased. I just remember that as a really positive experience running down there.
Did finishing third there open up a lot of doors for you then? In terms of racing opportunities, sponsorship?
Yeah, it did. But I mean, I, all the way through my career, I had a lot of problems with my Achilles and Achilles injuries, and it was always either hurting a little bit or hurting a lot. And, you know, that from that next winter, I had a lot of issues and problems with trying to get on top of it. So while it did open up opportunities and did give me some good sponsors and things, I spent a very long time after that battling, trying to get on top of these Achilles problems that I was having and Achilles injuries, which then curtailed the races that I could do.
So, and how much longer after that then were you able to keep racing at the level you wanted to?
Took about another 4 years. But as I say, there were some times when I'd fly over to an Ironman and hobble off the aeroplane and think, how on earth am I going to race Ironman in 2 days' time or whatever? And it was frustrating. And I, you know, I would say for me, that was probably the thing that made it the most frustrating, not being able to just race injury free those last few years, and always having to battle with pain in the, you know, Achilles tendonitis, which limited the amount of racing I could do.
What sort of treatments or approaches did you try then in order to say, cure it or limit it?
I mean, I tried lots of things. I tried having a cortisone injection. One of the doctors I saw asked me to have a cortisone injection. He then put it in a cast, and he said he wanted to put it in a cast to rest it and let it all settle down. And probably one of the stupidest things that I've done, which didn't help, was I decided after about 3 or 4 weeks that I'd had enough of this on my leg, and I cut it off. And then when it was off, obviously the cortisone was still taking effect. So I thought, oh, it's fine now, it's better. And I went and raced the half Ironman a few days later and actually got a tear in my Achilles from that. So that was a big lesson learned, that you need to, work with medical people and try and find a cure that's going to work, because certainly ignoring the pain and running through it didn't help.
Yeah, big lesson that. I was engaged in a conversation yesterday with somebody on Facebook who had fallen over and had twisted her knee and had knee problems, and she'd seen two doctors. And they'd both given a very similar opinion that it might need operating on, but she could afford to wait this year to have her cartilage operated on. But, you know, she had two half Ironman races that she wanted to do. But what she'd done was decided to go on Facebook and ask for a third opinion, because her hope was that they would tell her what she wanted to hear, which was, no, it'll be fine, you can carry on racing. And, of course, we know that the body doesn't work like that, does it? If you're in pain, there's a reason for it. And following standard procedures usually going to end up with the best results.
It is, you know, and I think that's the thing. I think the, you know, rest is often the best cure. And if I had my time again, I would have, you know, done more of it and maybe trained a little more sensibly. But then would I have enjoyed it as much? I don't know. Part of what I enjoyed was going out and doing excessively long sessions and, you know, back-to-back long sessions and back-to-back long races. And it may not have been the best thing for me in terms of performance outcome, but it was certainly what I wanted to do and what I enjoyed doing.
It's always a difficult one, isn't it? Because the things that you do that make you good and give you the happiness are often the things that you're undoing in the end, you know. And you know, you look at some of the athletes who've quite publicly said that they've got mental health issues, you know, and that exercise and training is what gave them some form of release. But actually, it could have been self-harm as well. So it's sort of like a double-edged sword for a lot of people.
I agree.
Let's talk a bit more about what happened after you finished racing then. So you set up you and Glenn became greater friends and then got together and eventually got married.
No, we're not married.
I'm saying that with confidence, and then realizing I need to backtrack a little bit.
We've been engaged many years, but we're not married yet. We have four daughters.
Okay. And you have the coaching business, Bodyworks, based in the Eastbourne area.
We do.
Okay. Was that a natural progression for you then, from racing to go into coaching, or was that the only option available to you?
No, I mean, I think it wasn't something that either of us had planned to do, but it was something that we both found we enjoyed doing. So. It was really just starting off quite small, coaching some individual people, and then we developed into a squad here, and now we have a sort of a full range of ages training on a daily basis. So it's been really good to develop it over the years, and along with swimming coaching specifically and running coaching.
How do you find your pool time? Because I know up here in Leeds, we have a lot of swimming pools, but getting access to those pools is hellishly difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult, and it's also extremely expensive, which makes it difficult, you know, for us. But the University of Brighton here is really, really good, and we work with them closely. So, you know, that's where we get our pool time from.
Do you do work in conjunction with the university then, and providing coaching services for the students that are there? As it sort of like a quid pro quo type of arrangement?
We hire the pool from the university, but I mean, Glenn lectures at the university as well. That's his, he's a lecturer on the sports coaching degree there. And so it's a separate thing, but the students who go to the university train with us.
Okay, and over the years, you have had some pretty talented athletes come through your coaching, haven't you? I know the Freeman siblings were part of that coaching setup at one point. For those of our listeners who don't know, Henrietta Freeman was, you know, would have been one of our up and coming superstars. Maybe what?
Yeah, 15 years ago. She's just started back into multi-sport, actually, looking to do Pontevedra in April. I think she's doing the aquathon.
Okay.
But she's just starting to come back into the sport now. So she's, back with us again. And then her brother Ollie obviously went to Beijing as a reserve. And Lil, the younger sister, was European youth relay competitor. Some strong ones. And then with Todd Leckie, who was, we've had quite a few national level athletes, but more importantly, we've had a lot of happy athletes who train hard.
Well, and that last phrase you mentioned there, Sarah, you've had a lot of happy athletes. And I'd like to go back to what you said right at the very beginning about your own development as an athlete. Roller skating, lots of play and enjoyment. Swimming in the sea, lots of play and enjoyment. Growing up and sort of developing as a triathlete, no tech, having fun, doing stuff because it was enjoyable. How much does that philosophy inform the way that you and Glenn coach now?
Well, I think it overrides my philosophy a lot, working with the younger athletes. I think the thing that I look for with young athletes when they come in and within the academy, because I coach with the Southeast Youth and Junior Academy, the thing I'm always looking for is to find the athletes that are leading their program, the ones that want to be there because they want to be there, the ones that are doing it for them, and the ones that are enjoying what they're doing. And I see with a lot of the younger ones, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of expectation, there's a lot of, in some cases, there's a lot of entitlement. And, you know, I think that's disappointing. You want to see them coming in excited to race, excited to train, having fun together. And, you know, as much as possible, that is my philosophy working with the younger athletes.
Mm. And I mean, it's, you know, there are certain ages for both boys and girls where keeping them in the sport becomes more of a challenge. And it's certainly a lot easier to keep them in the sport at those ages if they're actually having fun and enjoying what they're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, just at the performance assessments this past weekend, you saw the youth girls, there was over 100, and the junior girls, there's around 50. And bearing in mind that the junior girls is a 3-year age group and the youth girls is a 2-year age group, there's some awful lot of, you know, issue going on there. Some reason, you know, we're still not retaining girls at sort of 17, 18, 19, who are in there at 15 and 16. Mm. I think it's less so with boys. I think the boys' numbers were fairly good. And the retention of boys seems to be fairly good, but the retention of girls, you know, and I don't know what the answer is. I wish I did, but there is a huge dropout amongst 17, 18, 19s. And I think one of the areas that I think possibly is causing it is because they're over focusing on results, they're over focusing on outcomes of their seasons and outcomes of races, and not looking at just developing from where they're at and enjoying what they're doing. And they're not seeing that they can be good in the future. They're just looking at the right now and thinking, I'm not good enough, and stopping.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think triathlon's not alone in that, is it? I see and hear that in other sports that they have those same challenges in keeping those same age groups engaged.
It is. It's in all of the individual sports. I mean, I work in schools doing PE, and whereas at one time I would see year fives and year sixes really engaged with PE and really enjoying it and wanting to do it and taking part in extracurricular activities, now I see down as far as year five, they're stopping. You know, there's very few in the school that I was working in where they're doing any extracurricular activity. And year five, you've got to think that's 9 and 10. You know, it's starting earlier and earlier. It used to be when they got to secondary school, it would start to drop off, and now it's right down at 9 and 10. And that's a generalization, but I mean, I think across the board, it's becoming obvious that a lot of girls are very inactive at, you know, 11 upwards. So for girls of 15, 16, 17 to still be doing sport is unusual, and how they cope with that can be quite difficult because they're going against the norm. They're going against what all their peers are doing at school and what everyone else feels is normal for them, and it can be quite hard sometimes to stick with it.
Yeah, a perennial challenge for coaches, I think, and sort of a slightly different challenge to when people think of what coaching is about and helping to develop athletes. You know, your first challenge is actually to get them to come to the sessions before you can start to weave your magic
but
on that, what they're actually doing.
If you've identified at a young age that, and they've started to take ownership of what they're doing, so they're leading their program rather than a parent or a coach in terms of what they're looking to be doing. And I'm not saying that they do their design their own coaching, but in terms of choosing what races they're at and understanding what training they're doing, the more you can get them to lead what they're doing, I think possibly the more likely they are to stay in it, because they're doing it for themselves, they're not doing it for anyone else.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Maybe that's something that next time I'm delivering the high performance coaching program, we ask coaches to talk about is, you know, how do you encourage younger athletes to have more ownership and engagement in the program? And I suppose it's about that intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation as well, isn't it? If you're taking ownership of your program and leadership of that, then it's a drive that comes from within. So it's a bit like that's your reason why you're doing it. But if you're only doing it because, you know, you're living sport vicariously for your mum and dad, then that's not going to give you the motivation to actually turn up to the session.
It isn't. I mean, sometimes, you know, even little things that can start at a very young age, like a young athlete being responsible for making sure they've got a bottle at training. I mean, the amount of times I'll have a child say to me, oh, my mum didn't give me water this morning. It's things like that which need to change into, I forgot my water this morning, you know, and it's there. They can be in charge of remembering what they need for training. And it starts at a very, very young age, I think, getting their bag ready the night before, not relying on a parent to pack their kit bag, you know, and setting their alarm for getting up in the morning.
Right at the very beginning of the Talent ID program, Sarah, Glenn was involved in this as well. The regions were divided up. Jack and I were looking after the north of England. Glenn was looking after the southeast and that area around there. And then there were other people involved. Paul Buxton, who was in charge of that program then, I don't know if you remember Paul, had a syllabus, and I've been looking for this syllabus, and I don't know if I've got it on an old hard drive or somewhere, but as part of that syllabus, when they were 14 and 15 and they came into the program, and it was based on Islam Ali's long-term athlete development loosely, there were things like learning to get up, just as you've said there, learning to get up at the right time in the morning, being prepared with all of your kit, tidying your room, you know, making your bed in the same way that there's that famous YouTube clip of that American general saying, you know, that's the start of the day, is making your bed properly because it sets the discipline for the rest of your day. Turning up to sessions on time. If you're turning up to a squad weekend, you know, be properly turned out. And remember, you're representing British Triathlon. If you're going on a training camp, it's not a holiday. It's like work. And all of those things about personal management. I think a lot of that's overlooked when, people are looking at, can I swim, run, bike and run faster, but forgetting about all of the admin and lifestyle issues that surround that and actually develop somebody as a person, which is some of the things that they learn if they join the army, really. It's just about looking after the personal effect.
It is,
and
it's a really interesting one because, I mean, having had daughters who've been athletes as well, I know from a parent's perspective how easy it is to do things like pack bags and wake them up. And, it's very easy to do that. And actually, it's quite hard to step back and leave them to do it. And you're not being mean stepping back and leaving them to do it. In the long run, you're helping them. But from a parent's point of view, you can feel like you're being mean because you feel like you're overloading them, or it's something you can do for them, so I'll do it. But I've learned with mine that actually in the long run, you're doing them a favor, because they're then deciding that they're getting up because they want to get up for swimming. They're not getting up because you're yelling at them that it's time to get out of bed. They're getting up because they want to be on poolside at 6 o'clock. So,
yeah, and I think that, you know, some age group athletes could learn a lot from what you've just said, Sarah, in terms of, you know, having their personal admin right, turning up to sessions on time, having the right equipment, making sure they've got their own water bottle. These little issues that people overlook are not exclusive to
young teenagers. No, they're not. And I think do you know, I think the biggest difference now that would have helped me that wasn't around when I was doing it is the introduction of S&C and the S&C sessions, S&C exercises. I look now at that and think, gosh, if only I'd had access to that when I was young, a lot of my Achilles problems would have been sorted out. So I think, as well as the swim, bike, run, actually not overlooking the value of S&C and Pilates, yoga, you know, stretching, which just massively enhances programs. And people will often think, especially when they're on limited time, that they don't have time for that stuff, but I think it would enhance their sports so much by introducing those things.
One of my first articles I wrote for 220 was in 1995, and it was about strength training for triathletes, and I am still feel like I'm a flag bearer for this, and I still feel like I'm in the minority. I know it's becoming more common to read about it and hear about it. But if I go to a presentation and ask people to put their hand up if they're engaged in program like this year round, it's still only 25 to 30%. And I don't feel like I'm losing a battle, but I feel like it is an uphill struggle because, as you say, people with limited time think that the only way to be a better triathlete is to swim, bike and run more. And of course, you know, if they did a little bit less swim, bike and run and a little bit more strength training, the total result would be far better.
Unfortunately, my older daughter has had quite a few injury problems with very similar issues to the ones I had, which are on the mend. And, you know, she's getting herself a lot better now and is back training. But on that journey, having gone to some rehab with her and watched her, I've learned so much about stability. So as alongside the strength as well, just the basic stability exercises and things you can pick up in Pilates. And I mean, it's an absolute eye opener as to how it can enhance your training, especially for training for long distance, and enhance your training and avoid injury. I mean, if I had one thing that I would like to take from now back to then, it would be that.
Well, that's probably a good place to end, Sarah. The one lesson that if you could teach to people now about what you learned from then, it is that strength and conditioning is a vital addition to your performance. And, you know, going forward, as older human beings that you and I are, the continued participation in activities like that is what enables us to keep doing what we're doing as we get older.
I have a question for you, though. Did you do Norseman? Did you?
I did the Norseman, yes.
That's one event that I haven't done that I would absolutely have loved to or love to do. Because that reminds me of Ironman originally, what Ironman originally was like before it became a lot more commercial.
Well, maybe what we should do, Sarah, is have a private conversation about Norseman off air.
Okay.
And good. I'll tell you all about
it. Yes, I look forward to it.
Okay, well, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this conversation. That was Sarah Coop. Sarah was one of the leading lights in triathlon way back in the late 80s and early 90s. She is one of the legends that I'm enjoying chatting to, and I hope you're enjoying listening to, that really started to put triathlon for the UK on the map, on the world scene, and helped to build triathlon in Britain to the place where it is today. She's continued her good work with the developing athletes down in the southeast. And if you wanted to contact Sarah or find out about the coaching programs that they run, I'm going to give you, Sarah, a chance to tell you where she can or where you can contact her. So, Sarah, go ahead. This is your chance to
So let people know how to reach you. If anybody wants to find out about the program or coaching that we run down here, the email contact is bodyworks1, and that's as the number one, at AOL.com.
And your website, Sarah?
I need to check because we've updated it and we're changing it. So if you contact me initially by email, and then I can give you details of that.
Okay. Well, we'll put that email on the show notes as well, Sarah. Do you have anything like a Facebook page for your training group or an Instagram?
Yeah, we
page?
Have a Team Bodyworks, which is at which is on Facebook. Yeah.
Okay, so that's Team Bodyworks.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll put that one on there as well. Anywhere else where they can reach you?
We don't use a lot of social media.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure that anybody that wants to find you will be able to use those. So, Sarah, anything finally you'd like to say
before
we bid our listeners goodbye?
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no, it has been a pleasure. It's been great catching up with you. Hopefully I can get Glenn on as well to chat about his side of the story and his experiences. But for now, listeners, thank you very much for joining me. That was Sarah Coop. My name is Simon Ward, the host each week of the Triathlon Coach Swapcast. We'll be back next week with more fantastic guests. But for now, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your week.
That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWAT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose. And for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swimrun events. As a SWAT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWAT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information or If you're ready to press the button and join the SWAT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.